Welcome back to another episode of Dance Med Spotlight, where we talk about all things dance medicine and dance science. Today, my guest is Leah Bueno. She is the owner of Performance Pilates and Rehab and is company therapist for the Sacramento Ballet. She is an osteopathic manual practitioner, clinical Pilates instructor, and former professional dancer starting at a young age. In this episode, we talk about what is an osteopathic manual practitioner, things that she learned through her own experience as that young professional dancer, ways that studio owners, artistic directors, dance parents can be supporting their dancers in their overall health and wellness. We talk about some of the viewpoints from the dance medicine perspective, from the practitioner perspective of how we are working with our dancers, making sure that we're supporting them as human beings first and dancers second, because they still need to function out in the world as human beings when they're not dancing, and a lot of different other things, especially talking repetitive stress injuries, overuse injuries, all of those kinds of things too. To hear more about those topics and more, make sure that you check out the rest of this episode. Welcome back to another episode of Dance Med Spotlight, where we talk about all things dance medicine and dance science. Today, I have Leah Bueno with me. She is owner of Performance Pilates and Rehab, an osteopathic manual practitioner, Pilates instructor, and former professional dancer. Welcome, Leah.
Thank you for having me.
So, first question I always ask everybody on here is, give me, I guess, the short story version of what got you to this point of working in the health and wellness space with dancers.
Yeah, I'll try to make it brief. I've had many zigs and zags in my life. So I started dancing professionally. I was really young when I started dancing professionally. I was only 16. So as you can imagine, that is a lot on my adolescent growing body, working 8 hours a day, I think 6 days a week. So like most people, I started experiencing a lot of chronic aches and pains and injuries. I'm also very tall for a classical ballet dancer. I'm almost 6 feet tall. So I kind of got to the point in my mid-20s where between the injuries and the pain, the challenges with my height, I really thought that I wanted to pursue another career. So I decided to go back to school. My aspirations were actually to go to school for physical therapy. So, and like most schools do, I was set up with two PTs in the local area who worked with a lot of dancers. Unfortunately, my experience was really negative. Both of the PTs were not dancers themselves. I do not think you have to be a dancer to work with dancers, but I do think you have to have an interest in working with dancers to be able to provide care. So unfortunately, like I said, there was a lot of negativity in their clinic about working with dancers, what it's like to work with dancers, the PT profession itself. I was very young, so instead of looking at it for what it was of them kind of gaslighting me, I thought maybe the PT profession is not what I imagine it to be. You know, maybe there's all this work and I'm going to go through this. And is this going to be a healthy, happy career? So yeah. I unfortunately made the decision to go back to dancing professionally. I did that until I was in my early 30s. I always taught dance when I was dancing professionally. So when I retired, I transitioned into being an educator, did that for quite a while, worked with very high level elite schools of people wanting to also dance professionally themselves. But I always had something in me that wanted to work in a clinic. So I made the decision to go back and get my Pilates certification with a special focus in post-rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. I was very lucky. Right away, I was hired by the License Training Center for STOP Pilates, and I worked for them for years. They were a direct referral for a lot of physical medicine doctors, orthopedists in the area. We had a chiropractor next door to us who referred patients. So right away, I kind of got lumped into amazing mentorship, and I became a part of their rehabilitation team. I also became an instructor trainer for STOP Pilates, and that is when I was first introduced to osteopathy. In order to be an instructor trainer for STOP Pilates, you have to go to Toronto, which is their headquarters, and be trained directly from them. Mm-hmm. And I had never heard of osteopathy in the States. I remember we were sitting around talking one day and someone was like, oh, my shoulder hurts. And they're like, I need to go see my osteopath. And they kept bringing this up. And I was like, what is this osteopathy everyone keeps talking about? And there was a woman in the program who was actually going to school. So on one of the breaks, my shoulder was bugging me. So she offered to practice some of her techniques on me and kind of explain to me that it's, you know, it's a whole body approach. And we look at everything in the body besides just the area of complaint. And I remember her doing very little on my shoulder. She started kind of doing like a full joint eval. She worked a lot on my thorax and my ribs, my pelvis, my neck. And I even thought at one point, you know, should I remind her that it's my shoulder that that hurts?
Yeah.
And then, you know, she stood up and she's like, let's retest and see how it feels. And it felt really, really good. And I just thought, how interesting to, you know, we're so used to going into quick, you know, spaces with American healthcare, treating the pain. And I just thought it was really a neat experience. But, you know, I went back to the States and I went back to doing what I was doing. I had a lot of great results with Pilates as the only tool in my toolbox with the physical medicine patients. But with the dancers, I knew enough to know I needed to know more. And I was getting really kind of stuck in what I could offer them, how I could help them. Through the magic of the internet, I was teaching an online class for dancers, and I became connected to a dance physical therapist in Connecticut, Samara DiMattia. And she had been working in dance medicine for over 20 years. She was one of Marika Molnar's original PD aides, just a lot of experience. And so I started sending her all of the dancers that I felt like something wasn't making sense and I needed more information. And she was doing consults via telehealth. And that changed my life. I had, I, you know, that's what I had always imagined, I think, when I was in my 20s, wanting to be a PT. And the care she was able to provide was what I wanted to do. I had an honest conversation with her about what I envisioned for myself and the path I wanted. And she was the one who really empowered me to feel like it was okay if my path looked different from other people. And, you know, it's okay that I didn't follow the same route as everyone else.
Yeah.
So I took that experience I had in Canada, and it's very common in Canada and in Europe for people to mesh Pilates and osteopathy in their practice. Mm-hmm. So I took a lot of time to figure it out. But I figured out how to get my diploma from an osteopathic college in Canada. They had a hybrid program, so I could do that while living in the States. Nice. And I got my diploma in osteopathic manual practice. I have my own practice now. I'm a company therapist for Sacramento Ballet. And I'm really just trying to find ways to help dancers, probably specifically with more of the repetitive strain kind of injuries that we see so often, and using a holistic whole body approach to do so. I love it.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think that's a really important point that you brought up there is, you know, your journey maybe didn't look how many typically do of, you know, going a certain direction with where you wanted to get additional training or that kind of thing, but you still ended up in this really beautiful balance of places, being able to bring together the Pilates and the osteopathic medicine together for dancers and have incredible results for them, which I think is amazing.
Yeah, I agree.
Thinking about, well, actually, before I even go down this route, let's, for the audience sake, for people who are not familiar what osteopathic manual therapy is, tell us a little bit about what the heck that is and how it might be different from other similar professions like PT.
100%. That is the only regret I have, is I spend my life trying to explain to people what it is that I do. So osteopathy has been around for a really long time. It was originally founded by A.T. Stills in 18-something, 20-something, I always forget. But basically, it was when traditional medicine was pretty barbaric. So he wanted to find ways to help people to heal using manual techniques. The principles behind osteopathy are that our body is a really amazing self-regulating system. And most of the time, our body has the superpowers to heal itself. So as therapists, we are not doing that heavy lifting of healing. Your body is doing the job. It's our job to kind of help it along its way, find any limitations that might be going on in the body of why, how we can kind of supercharge your healing potential. And, you know, this might not be how everyone thinks about it, but this is how I think about osteopathy, and I think about the marriage of Pilates with it. In one of my very first classes, the professor asked, how do we define health in the human body? And I think, you know, most of us thought, well, absence of disease, right? Like if we don't have anything going on, we're pretty healthy. But we know that's not the case, because sometimes we can be unhealthy for a long time, and it doesn't mean you're going to have pain in the musculoskeletal system. It doesn't mean you're going to have issues with the body. And they defined it as your body's ability to have good movement in all of the systems. So a lot of times we think about movement as just muscles and joints, but if you really think about it, our cardiovascular system is constantly pumping blood and moving. Our lymphatic system is taking things, you know, even on a micro level, if you've ever seen fibroblasts kind of sped up, they kind of look like little slugs, like going through your body, cleaning up the tissues. So really what I think of is I facilitate movement in people one of two ways. I either use my hands or I use my voice to instruct movement. And, you know, with the manual side of things, I can be very specific. So I can use my hands to be very specific of what joint and how I want it to move, how I want the tissue to move. And then I usually use that as to kind of monitor symptoms so that people can go back to movement. And then that's where really the nitty gritty work comes in. So again, we use the manual stuff just to kind of make you feel better, facilitate good, healthy movement through all of our systems of the body. And then we enforce it with movement training. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, that's definitely kind of my viewpoint from the PT lens also is, you know, I use my hands a lot more maybe early on with somebody, because there's also kind of that element of just like therapeutic touch can be good for the body and that kind of thing to help things feel better and make it calm down. But I can tell a lot from my hands. Ultimately, exercise is what really like reinforces things and helps build habits for how their body moves and that kind of stuff. And things that I always think about that I think is so fascinating about the body is the relationship from one piece to another. Like for shoulder or neck pain, a lot of times people are expecting that that is the primary place where we're going to be doing work. But there's a ton of research that shows working on upper spine and ribs and all of that make an immense impact on how shoulder and neck function. So that ends up being a big part of what I end up doing. And that's true of many different areas of the body. It's, we don't just exist as like a single joint moving.
Yeah. And I also think, you know, there's a big push right now. I don't know if you see this as well, but like a lot of the European physios are really trying to talk about how, you know, manual therapy isn't doing anything. We don't have good research behind it. And to some degree, I can get on board with that. But I do think that we have to realize, like you said, we're working with a human being. And even sometimes just having them lay down on your table, relax, you know, let their nervous system calm down. And we can be very specific with our touch for analysis. That's actually what I find the biggest benefit, because when I was just doing Pilates, all I had was my eyes. Yeah. I would look at someone, I could see them move, but I wasn't feeling how much range of motion each particular joint had. I wasn't feeling their tissue texture. I wasn't feeling their end range feel. You know, there's so much that we can do with our hands. One of my mentors always says that her fingers are her smart bits. And I really think that's true. It's like, it really informs us as well, because we're human beings as well. And our fingers have so much sensory organs to them.
Most definitely. One thing I want to go back to that you mentioned earlier also is starting to work as a professional dancer at a very young age. What is something that maybe now, knowing all the things you know, that you either wish that you had understood better as a young dancer in that position, or things that you wish your instructors and artistic directors and whomever were sort of, you know, in some sort of leadership and training position for you? What do you wish they knew for you back then?
That's a really good question. I have a few. So, you know, if you follow me on social media, I talk a lot about the dangers of aggressive overstretching. I do that because that is what I think did me in my professional career. So an adolescent's body is different than an adult's body, and in so many different ways. So for me, I was still growing. I mean, I didn't reach my full height until I was 19, 20, I think. Mm-hmm. So I was still growing during this time. People would always tell me that I needed to work on my flexibility. And so I did that in, again, a kind of the passive stretching that we all used to do in those days. Sylvie Guillaume had just kind of come onto the scene. So everybody wanted their legs to touch their head, and she was my hero, and I wanted that too. My mother stretched me every night for an hour, and I probably did even more than that. So mm-hmm. what happened to me was when my body kind of settled as an adult, my body changed. And I had developed all of this kind of ligament laxity and stretch through my tissue that I believe was really kind of holding me together as an adolescent. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't prioritizing strength at all, because that was not what my weakness was. My weakness was flexibility. So, I mean, I could jump, I could turn, but my extensions were not where they need to be. My turnout was not where it needed to be. So again, my body kind of settled, and then I lost all of my structural support. So I wish my teachers and the company directors would have thought of me as an adolescent, because I was, and treated me differently, and my expectations for what I should be doing at that time, I wish would have been different. So that's kind of the first one. And then the other one that I wish I would have had is, I started off as an apprentice, and because I was young and I was an apprentice, I didn't have any access to the healthcare teams that came and worked with the dancers.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was really hard. And even the company dancers, I believe the first company I worked with, they had someone come maybe once a week who volunteered. You know, it still wasn't ideal, but at least they had someone that they could talk to. So I was away from my parents for the first time. I was very young. I didn't know how to manage my body. And I was just trying to do everything I could to manage it. And I made some really bad decisions, unfortunately. So I wish I would have gotten a little more guidance.
Mm-hmm. I think both of those are really important to talk about too, because, you know, like thinking of your first point of wishing that they understood that an adolescent body is different and what it should be able to do and how it does things and how we should be training that body. That's definitely something I see a lot, unfortunately, in the young dancers that I see, where, you know, the hours that they're putting in and some of the overstretching stuff. Like, I've seen dancers where they're still getting put up on yoga blocks for splits and getting pushed into splits or things like that, or, you know, using some of those stretch bars to just like latch themselves onto and that kind of thing. And yeah, I mean, there's just so much that I think if we just understood what we're doing to the body now and how that's going to affect how it is later, we might rethink how we do some of these things in the studio.
Yeah. I actually was talking to a friend recently who was a professional dancer, and she had a really good point. And, you know, she said when she became a professional dancer, all of the women who were very kind of Gumby and loosey-goosey and stretched out didn't end up lasting very long because they had a higher incidence of injury. Even partnering was harder for them because they kind of, you know, were that Gumby Lucy body. They had a lot of challenges. And so her point was, if the job of an educator to get somebody to a professional career, if that's their aspiration, we need to be preparing them for the professional career, not just to get them in the door.
Yes. most definitely. And as you're talking about that, it makes me think of Dr. Catherine Vargo, who is a physio in the dance space. And one of her comments that I hear a lot, a quote, is, "With great mobility comes great responsibility." And how, you know, if we are going to work on that extra mobility and flexibility, then we really need to make sure that we're also going up with our strengthening and being able to support that extra flexibility or mobility too. So it's not just like we can't just work on one. We need to make sure that we're doing both if we're going to go down that route too.
100%. Oh, I fully agree with that. Mm-hmm.
Also thinking about kind of that second piece of, so like first you were talking about that flexibility piece and just like making sure of how we're supporting a body that is adolescent versus an adult. And then also, now I'm forgetting what the second piece was.
Oh, I didn't have access to the healthcare team.
Oh yes, access to the healthcare piece. So thinking of the access to the health providers, one thing that I'm seeing change, but would love to see you change even more, is that access piece. I think we've seen it now at the professional level, starting to expand to who gets included in that. Sometimes I'm seeing it into now the adolescent, you know, kind of typical dance studios, mostly for their competitive dancers. I'd love to see it go also all the way to our recreational dancers and people who are just doing it for fun, but they still need support for their body. What have you been noticing as far as any trends of like who's getting access or how that's going in communities that you're in?
So if there are any directors or studio owners listening, I have a tip for you. So yes, one trend that I am seeing is, so I do get the luxury of during summer programs. So I'm very close to the Sacramento Ballet, except I'm one of their company therapists. So a lot of the dancers who are coming from other places come to see me when they're in town, and I get to talk to them in my little private room and hear their stories. And a lot of the younger dancers who are looking for maybe a professional track are telling me that they are strategically picking companies and places that have, again, access to providers or are known to have healthy programs. Sacramento Ballet artistic staff is fabulous. I am very, very lucky, and they really do care about their dancers. And many of them have told me that they come from other companies to Sacramento, even though it's a smaller company, right? They're actually choosing to come here because they've heard it's a healthy environment and it's a good program. So that's marketing. You know, if you, and I also think just our society after COVID, a lot of people are thinking about their health and wellness in a way that they never have before. So yes. I've heard from a lot of parents that they're researching studios, and it's not just about the day of the past where who wins the competitions and who gets their kids into Juilliard. It really is looking at it as a whole and seeing if it's a healthy place for their kids. And mm-hmm. I think that is one of the biggest shifts I've seen in even just the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. I've seen that same thing where parents are starting to ask more of those questions if they're looking for a spot for their kids to go to, the dancers themselves. I know one that I actually interviewed early on in this whole podcast journey. She's a professional ballet dancer, and she loves the company that she's with because they are very supportive with health and wellness, and also being more open to different body types and, you know, all of that sort of thing. And that's one of the things that she loves about being with the company that she's with. And so, yeah, 100% agree. Studio owners, artistic directors, whomever is in charge of things, maybe you should have this included. If there weren't a million other reasons why it would be important, here's another one just from the business side.
Exactly.
And it can look a lot of different ways too. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have people hired on staff to be supporting a company or a studio. It could just be that you have relationships with people in the community that you send people to. You know, it doesn't have to look any one way in order to have that support.
100%. And I think, you know, we all have our dream teams. And by dream teams, you mean I have my physical medicine doctors, my orthopedists, my sports massage therapists, my strength and conditioning coaches. Like, I have my list of people when I need to send somebody somewhere that is either out of my scope or just not what I'm good at. I know who I'm going to send people to. And I think that that is something that educators can do themselves. And it can be sometimes scary just to reach out to someone you don't know. But I think most of us are pretty nice. And especially in the health and wellness factor, like, we just want the best for everybody. And we want the dancers to get back to dancing. I think that's the other thing I really hope that directors and studio owners understand is that, yes, sometimes we do have to pull the plug and sometimes we do have to say, okay, we're going to modify activity or this is dangerous. But at the end of the day, we're all on the same team. We want this dancer to get back into the studio just as much as you do.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I know when I have those conversations with my dancers, it is always, especially having been a dancer, having been an injured dancer growing up, it breaks my heart every time I have to tell them, like, we need to pull you, even if it's for a few weeks. Like, I know it's in their best interest, but still it's like, oh, my dancer heart hurts right now. But yeah, it ultimately is for their benefit to get them back to it, and not just back for the meantime, but to have that longevity that you were talking about before, not just getting them to that next step, the next competition, the next show, whatever it is, letting them have the career that they want. And not making their body quit on them.
Yeah. Before. I always tell people, I want them to dance for as long as they want to dance. Mm-hmm. And I don't care if it's recreational, professional, what be it, but I agree. Same thing. It breaks my heart. I have been there. I understand. And I like what you said about not just for the short term, because I'm sure you see the same in your practice. Getting out of pain is oftentimes when there's no, mechanism and injury, it's just part of the process. It's step one of the process. And it's really important for dancers, especially if they want to have a long, healthy career, that they get to the bottom of things when they have the time to do so. So what I mean by that is, for all of our adolescents, yes, maybe you have a performance or a competition that means a lot to you, but if you want to go on to dance collegiate or professionally, or if recreational, like if you want to be a super amazing swing dancer who's got competitions for long periods of time, we want you to be able to do those things when those important moments come up. So for our younger dancers, I know it seems scary to maybe modify your activity for a couple of weeks, but trust me, it's in your benefit to just get to the bottom of things as quickly as you can.
Mm-hmm. I think to build off of that too is not only taking the time to really get to the root of the problem and get things back on track, but also not sort of just stopping when you're out of pain, when you feel like you've kind of gotten through that thing that brought you in the first place. A lot of times there is more to the story that we can be working on to prevent something like this, or at least reduce the risk of it happening again, or a different body part or whatever. And so not just stopping as soon as it feels better.
Yes. And if you have any advice of how to communicate that, I am all ears, because I work really, really hard to get people to understand, because it's hard. And I understand myself. Pain is a very motivating factor. Mm-hmm. So you're in pain, you don't feel good, you want to get out of pain. I get that. And then it can be very deceiving, because then you go, well, I'm no longer in pain, so I must be better. How I try to explain it to my dancers and parents is, oftentimes with dance, we have this repetitive stress, kind of the overuse. And I always ask the question to myself, why is that tissue getting overloaded? And if we're not getting to the bottom of why things, what is the driver? What happened to that tendon? Why is it overworking? And then if you don't make a change to whatever was causing it, you're going to go back to the studio. You're going to feel better for a little bit, and then it might come back. And then every time it comes back, I feel like it's always just a little longer journey. Mm-hmm. And we want to it's just so much better if you just get to the bottom of it in the beginning.
Yes. a conversation I recently sort of changed the way that I was approaching some of this. So, you know, it's been a recent change, so I haven't seen quite how it's playing out yet, but I'm very curious, is when I have a dancer come in and we start handling whatever pain or whatever it was that brought them in the first place, as we're getting to a point where like we're approaching the end, air quotes around that, of what's going on, I start talking about, okay, well, tell me about what's coming up, what shows, what competitions, what auditions, summer intensives, whatever this might be looking like, change in their training schedule, and start kind of setting the scene for, okay, well, Nutcracker season is done now, and we've got comps coming up starting in the new year. How are we going to now prepare your body for all of that? Because those are different demands, different needs than what we've been working on so far. So like, we've gotten you to this point, we've gotten you through this chunk of your schedule. Now we need to prepare you for the next one. And so, you know, like I said, we're at the beginning of that conversation, but I'm curious if it maybe changes how that works out.
Yeah. And I think it's also important not to, you know, wag our fingers at people. And I love, you know, motivating them by talking about what's important to them, because I think that's going to add a lot more value. You know, I always joke that I'm the dentist of the dance world. please brush your teeth, please floss. But it is really important, because it is your instrument. I do think one issue that I run into, and I'm curious if you feel the same, is the scheduling for dancers is so hard, because they're doing so much, especially for our competition dancers. I mean, I have some studios where they get to a certain season and they are at competition every weekend. And how do we fit in time to, you know, see the healthcare providers you need to see, do the rehearsals, do the comps, still be a human being, go to school and have fun time with your friends? Like, it's really hard to fit it all in. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Yeah. Some of my competitive dancers, they like one of the studios, I think they do like 13 or 14 comps in a 5-month period. So it's like almost every weekend for that entire time. Plus they're getting ready for spring show. Plus they have their regular dance classes and all of that sort of thing. And like you said, they're still a human, they're still a student and a kid and all of these other things. And I think sometimes kind of what it feels like, at least looking at it, both from my dancer lens growing up and how things were then, as well as just what I'm seeing as a PT and talking to my dancers, is it seems like we're pushing more and more and more of these like technique classes, and when in doubt, add more technique, add private lessons, add summer intensives and blah, 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 rather than allowing for rest breaks, allowing for cross training, you know, all of these other things that we now are learning are really beneficial. But I think we've just like gone so far down with the pendulum of technique classes and private lessons and things. I don't know how we rein that back in again.
Yeah, that's really hard. And I agree with you. I mean, I have had conversations with parents where, you know, they tell me, oh, I can't bring my daughter to see you. Like, she's out. Her hip is just really hurting. But then they tell me, oh, I can't, because we have a private lesson and we have a rehearsal and a this. And, you know, in the nicest way possible, I try to communicate to them, but they won't be able to do all those things if they're injured or if they're in pain. But it's hard, because a lot of studios, I think, do also require certain things. And like you said, all of the adding. I had a conversation with a studio owner a couple of years ago, and I put something on social media about trying to follow the hours per week for chronological age. Like, if they're 15, like, let's try to keep them around 15 hours per week. And she had a very honest thing to say. And she goes, I would love to do that, but the studio down the street really does so much more. And my parents think that more is better, right? So if I'm taking away hours, it appears as if I'm not giving the students as much, and then they're not going to have as much benefit. So I don't know how we're going to do this, but I think the more we can talk about, you know, more is not better. What are we really trying to do? If you're exhausted, you will not perform your best. If you're exhausted, you are going to have more injuries. Your body is going to break down. And we really need to look at it as all of us, what can we do to help these dancers dance their best?
Yes. And that fatigue thing is huge, where we have dancers that are dancing hours on end, no break, no time to refuel, maybe grab a sip of water, but that's about it. And day after day after day, rehearsal after rehearsal. And yeah, eventually it's going to catch up with their bodies, which is an unfortunate thing. And, you know, I'm even seeing some studios now where, like, for the holidays, they're offering maintenance classes so that you don't, you know, fall out of conditioning with a week or two off, when in fact that would be the perfect thing for the body, is to have a week or two off.
Yeah, but I have to say, you know, I do have a unique perspective being a dance educator for so long before. And I try to think back to what I thought about back then. And, you know, what's hard is there is no governing body to teach dance. You know, like, anybody who was a dancer can teach dance. I know 100%. I knew nothing about the body, anatomy, physiology, anything when I started teaching dance. And all I really had was what I did, what worked for me, I thought worked for me. So I think not only podcasts and things that are getting the information out there, but I think the more that we can have education programs for dance teachers and really have them understand, like you said, that break is actually going to benefit your dancer. Because if they don't know that, it's very easy to say, oh, well, don't, you know, we don't want you to get out of shape, so we're going to offer this. And I do think they do it with the dancer's best interests at heart. Mm-hmm. But we need to educate them that there are actually better ways.
Yes. And I think finding those opportunities to get in front of dance educators and parents, if they're adolescent dancers, like those two, if we could really find ways to get in front of them and share some of this information more effectively, I think that's where we can maybe affect a little bit more change more quickly, versus the single dancer who comes in to work with us one-on-one and slowly chipping away at the block of all of it.
The example I use all the time, I heard this on a podcast and I don't remember what one, so don't quote me on this. So I believe this is accurate, but someone was talking from sports medicine about how professional football players, for example, or baseball players, that they are actually fined in their off season if they are doing their sport during their off season. And the reason they do that is because these are million-dollar athletes that they want them to have their season come up, and they're going to perform at the top of their, if they can. And they know that if they are doing their sport in the off season, that it's going to be to their detriment. So that's the example I use to my dancers.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I like that a lot. Yeah. I've been doing more trying to find, you know, like, there's dance educator conferences sometimes, or dance coach conferences and things like that. Or, you know, offering parent sessions at studios, that kind of thing. But yeah, I think that's the group to get in front of for all of this.
I agree. And the parent one, I'm so glad you said that, because I say that all the time, because it's the job of the parents to care for their children. That is literally their job. And I think that, you know, a lot of parents that come into my office, they say this, is I didn't come from a dance background.
Yes.
So I don't know what is normal. Mm-hmm. And if all you've ever heard is, let's go back to the passive stretching. Like, if all you've ever heard is, this is what dancers do. We do this passive stretching. We dance this many hours. We do those things. And you don't know how to defend your child, you're going to just go, well, that's okay. And I understand it, because we tell parents that we have a dancer who we're going to give them this little pair of point shoes that is made out of basically like paper mache, and they're going to stand on their toes. And trust me, that's safe. So how do they navigate that?
Yes, I love that. It's so true. It's one of the reasons I really appreciate also when I'm able to have dancers in to do like a point readiness assessment or something like that. And so often once the parents are in there and seeing what all we're checking and hear what we're talking about and all of that, they go, why isn't this something that everyone has to do? And it's a very good question.
Yeah, no, I love my parents. I think my parents are superheroes, and the ones especially that bring in, you know, them younger before they've been injured, before something happened. Yeah, you guys are my heroes.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Let's go back to something that we were talking about a bit earlier, this idea of overuse injuries. Let's dive into that a little bit more. You had already mentioned something along the lines of, we see these overuse injuries, but there are other things that we can be working on to help maybe reduce the risk of that happening in the first place. Talk to us a little bit more about what that means.
Yeah. So if there's any, again, dancers or maybe don't come from a health and wellness background, I think the word overuse is misunderstood a lot. So one thing when I talk to dancers, let's use a hip, for example, like their hip is really cranky and it's not feeling good. And then I think dancers hear overuse and they think overuse of a specific movement. So they're doing a solo where they have to lift their leg up, you know, 20 times in the solo, and they're doing that a lot. And so I think oftentimes they're very afraid that if they come in to see a provider, the provider is going to tell them to stop lifting their leg, and that's the only way to get over it, and they're not going to do that, so tough luck, right? Mm-hmm. And we don't really mean it. I think of it as there needs to be a balance of all things. So you already talked about a balance of mobility versus strength. You need to make sure that you have control of your mobility. You have balance in the joints. So oftentimes for dancers, they're very mobile in specific joints. So hypermobile maybe in their hips and their feet, but hypomobile in their thorax and their neck, or, you know, and that imbalance is going to really affect. So there's some part of the body that is often doing the job of all the other things around it. So like our musculoskeletal system, like we have muscles that it's their job to be deep, tiny little stabilizers. And if those deep, tiny little stabilizers aren't on board, your big power muscles are going to have to try to work to stabilize things. Those are the things that get cranky, that, you know, get painful. And so it's with this like repetitive stress. And the other thing to mention is you need to have the capacity to handle that amount of load. So, you know, I think we're all familiar at this point with the Australian Ballet Study that they had to do, you know, I don't remember however many calf raises, releves, mm-hmm. and they saw a reduction in their injuries. Yep. So it's, are your hip flexors strong enough to lift your leg 50 times in a single class? Are, you know, and it's everything on board, everything working as it should, balance and mobility. And that's what I try to think about when I'm talking about like repetitive strain stuff.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about that too, it's like going back to that balance idea of like ballet in particular, we like live in turnout, but we also have to have the opposite muscles, the muscles that make us toe in, our internal rotators, be strong to maintain balance in our body. We can't just train one and sort of forget the other side of the joint. And so, you know, finding all of those different balance points, and that's the beauty of working with any number of types of health and wellness folks in the community. We can help you figure that part out and like what needs work, how do you work on it, all of that kind of thing. It's not something where the dancer themselves needs to be doing the research to figure it out for themselves, or the dance teacher adding one more thing to their plate to help their dancers navigate. Utilize the resources around you, like us, to help figure that out and make sure that we have the appropriate types of balance throughout the body and the way that it functions and all of that.
Yeah, I love that you use the internal rotation example. I use that a lot. I also, if you haven't noticed, I talk to my dancers about being human beings a lot. And so, you know, I'll go, okay, so you're in the studio, how many hours a day? Do you walk about in the real world? And they're like, yes, of course. Well, part of our gait pattern has to be internally rotating as we push off. And if you don't have that capacity in your hips, I would say probably the majority of dancers, when I do an assessment of the hip, have very little to no internal rotation passively.
Yes, agreed.
Like, it's just not there. So you are, yes, living life and turnout in the studio, but then you're also living life in external rotation all the time. And it's no wonder we have so many FAI impingements and labral tears. It's your hip is not sitting, or your femoral head is not sitting centered in the acetabulum. And that will be problematic for life as well as dance.
Yeah. I remember a recent discussion with Dinah Hampson from Pivot Dancer. We were kind of talking about this idea of how we're training and that kind of thing, but like making sure that we're training the body for all of the movements that we're expecting of it. And so if you think about even within dance itself, if you're maybe getting into some of the modern and contemporary and some other things like that, there might be things where you're getting yourself in a position where technically that leg has to go into internal rotation, but we're never actually training it that way outside of that movement in choreography maybe. Or, you know, like, especially when we're getting out of some of the ballet stuff, I feel, or like traditional classical ballet, we're getting ourselves in those positions and in, you know, loading joints in a different way and that kind of stuff, but we're not training like that. And so making sure we're really well-rounded with our training is important to support what it is that we want to be able to do.
Yeah, we ran into that with Sacramento Ballet dancers this season. The very first repertoire that they learned was, oh, I'm forgetting the choreographer's name, but it was kind of a Netherlands dance theater style. So there was a lot of body weight kind of choreography. There was a lot of big back bends, but the body weight specifically was not something that the company had done, if ever or in a while. And we did run into some issues that I don't think they were fully prepared for that. So the director and I talked, and I think next season I want to look at what rep is coming up. And how do I prepare them for the repertoire if it is different than just our classical ballet? Because you're right, that's really, really important.
Also having people who understand some of the different genres of dance and some of the different demands, whether or not they've done it themselves, but just being able to kind of analyze the movement and have that understanding. Because I know, like, through some of the different groups that I've gotten to present with or that sort of thing, I've had exposure to classical Chinese dance and Bollywood and, you know, who knows what all, lots of different genres that are out there, all the different swing styles and ballroom and Latin and who knows what all. But they all have different demands for the body and for the movements that they're doing. And so being able to look at that and go, okay, this is a little bit different. How do we now support this that looks very different than a plie in ballet or something like that?
100%. I remember the first time I worked with an Irish dancer and I was blown away because here I am in my little ballet bubble and I'm like, we have a tough job on our bodies. And then the Irish dancer walked in and said, well, I need to have 180 degrees of turnout. I need to stay as high onto my toes as possible. I need to not move my arms, not move my upper body, and not bend my knees as I jump. And I just went, I don't know how you do that.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, that's one of the things I love too about just like watching dance and different styles. It's just going, ooh, that's new and different. How do you do that?
And the shoes too. I mean, coming from, like, you know, the ballroom shoes have a different issue. The Irish dance shoes have a big issue. You know, like the tap You know, it's all just, it's all very, very different. And you're right, you need to be able to adapt and understand what the challenges were. That is one thing that I am very thankful of because of my height. I've had a very eclectic career. So I started off in ballet. I was actually a showgirl in Las Vegas for a while. So I did that. That was a very, you know, talk about wearing heavy costumes we had an elevator in our stage. So we had a lot of, yeah. So there's like big gaps in the stage. So we had a lot of incidents where we get our shoes stuck in a gap and then something would get pulled. Yeah. So you have to just think about it all. It's all really, the costumes though were the what did me in Vegas.
Oh, I'm sure. I think something else that we've kind of, I think, hinted at in our discussion, but I want to kind of bring to the forefront a little bit, is this whole idea of kind of the whole body, the whole human that is in front of us. We've talked a lot about how, you know, for hip stuff, maybe we're looking at things in the spine or, you know, yes, we have those relationships, but also making sure that we're maintaining the overall health of the human in front of us and not just focusing on the physical side, how their muscles are performing, all of that.
Yeah. This was really hard for me when I was first in school. So, you know, an osteopathic program, you learn about obviously the joints and the muscles and joint mobilizations and myofascial release and all that kind of stuff. But you also spend a lot of time with like visceral work and making sure that vascular system, you can do treatments for that. And I remember I was a little bit of a brat in the beginning because I kind of thought, I'm not going to use this. You know, I'm going to go off and I'm going to work with dancers and I only want to know about the musculoskeletal system. Why do I have to know about the liver? Mm-hmm. And I had a teacher and she must have kind of caught on to that because we were doing some treatments and I think we were doing like a vascular treatment. And then she kept pointing out, this will be really good for Leah because if she can help her dancers have a healthy, you know, vascular system, that's going to help their healing potential. We were doing cranial work and she's like, this will be really good for Leah because she's going to be working with performers that are very high stress. And this is going to help them kind of regulate their nervous system. And I really needed that to understand how every system of our body needs to be on board, even if I'm mostly concerned with our musculoskeletal system, because we put things into categories as people because it's easier for us to understand.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. It's like, here's the muscular system, here's lymphatic system, but our body doesn't think that way. Our body is just, it's all working together. Its primary objective is survival. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't know that you care mostly about your dance, but it does know that if it feels danger or stress, be that within the gut, maybe it can be your respiratory system is not on board as much. Like your body will put attention to that area because it senses danger. And we never know how that's going to come about. So you can have pain referrals from something that is your visceral system. And you might go, you know, I have this spot in my rib cage that drives me crazy. And mm-hmm. if I do a liver treatment, I feel better. That took me a really hard time to kind of figure that out. And I had to experience that on myself because it does kind of feel a little bit like, well, but this hurts. Why are we doing something over here?
Right.
But it is really, really important.
Yeah. I know one thing that kind of brought that to light for me was early in my PT career, I was working in the hospital and had gotten injured working with a patient, hurt my back really badly. And shortly after that, I started having a lot of GI stuff pop up like a month or two later. And I, you know, growing up, I had always kind of had like a troubled tummy as a kid, but like it really started causing a problem. And I was kind of dealing with them as two completely separate issues for a while. And then somewhere along the way, I can't remember who it was. I think it was actually a chiropractor that I was working with years later, once I felt like both things had mostly resolved and kind of realizing how some of these things interconnect, even shared innervations of like the stomach versus where my injury was in my back. they had some shared nerve roots and things like that. And it was like, huh, this is fascinating, the timing of how this came about, and noticing times when, like, if my back was flaring up, my stomach would feel worse. If my stress was flaring up, my back would feel worse. You know, all of these things that then started seeing interconnected. It was like, oh, okay, maybe there's more to all of this than these, again, distinct systems that we think of.
Yeah. And, you know, I forget who it was. Someone told me one time, I think this is a good way to explain it to people. Your body hugs what it senses danger with. So, you know, it's like a knot in a t-shirt. So it really is going to, wherever it is in the body, if it feels like there's something going on, you know, even for our female athletes, if they have any issues with their menstruation or, you know, their body is going to like hug that. I think that's a good example, because I think a lot of women have experienced back pain, you know, during menstruation, and they kind of like, oh yeah, I know what that's like. So, you know, it is really important that we talk about everything. I think, and most people who are really great practitioners like yourself are talking about that with their clients as well, and sleep and digestion and stress, and, you know, it's all important.
Mm-hmm. And I wish that is something that was emphasized more in a lot of our trainings across the board, because I think sometimes, regardless of what profession you're in, we kind of have this lens of like, okay, this is what I'm working on, this is what this other person works on, when in fact, there's so much of this that is interrelated, and just understanding that they have influences on one another, whether or not I myself as a physical therapist can do anything about it, I at least am aware, am asking the questions, and then have referrals to be able to fill in those gaps.
Yep, 100%.
At this point, I think it is a great opportunity for a special segment on the show. So we have the final bow. Essentially, this is your parting message, your take-home message. We've talked about so many different things throughout our time together on this episode. What is the main thing that you want someone listening to take away with them?
I think the main thing I want someone to take away is that if you're working with dancers, to understand that they are a human first, it's a whole body approach. And I will steal a quote from Ida Rolf, is she would always say, where the pain is, it ain't. So we need to be really looking at everything, taking whatever their pain complaint is into consideration, but almost putting that off to the side, being objective when we're doing our assessments, and really trying to find the root of the problem so that you can hopefully help them for the longevity of their career.
Mm-hmm. And if you had a message for someone in the dance community, whether it's dancers themselves, dance educators, studio owners, artistic directors, what's one tidbit that you want them to walk away with?
Get your team before you need them. I think that's, you know, have your Rolodex of people so that if something comes up, you're not wasting time and stressing yourself out by trying to find someone. The other thing that I'm sure you would agree with is really beneficial is if I have seen someone before an injury occurs, that helps me out a lot, because sometimes people come into your office and they have, you know, limited mobility in a joint, or, you know, that's a good example. And it's kind of like, has it always been this way? You know, is this because of the injury? But if you know them before, you know their habits, that can really inform your treatment.
Mm-hmm. I think that's such an important point too, because there are a lot of things, if we just had a person in front of us that we, as we're testing, we may go, oh, this feels short or tight or less mobile or, you know, something. Whether or not that actually is a problem is a whole nother thing. And so if we don't have that context, it makes it harder to sort through that. Not to say that we still can't figure out a solution and get them on the right path, but it might let us zero in a little bit easier, rather than kind of sorting through of like, well, I think this was fine before.
Yes, I agree 100%. And that's a good point too, because short and tight is not always a problem. And I think in the dance world, we freak out, like everything must be long and stuff.
Yes. No, please no. Then the very last thing before we end our session together here is shameless plug. So you have the opportunity to plug anything that you have going on. This is your chance.
Yeah, so I am online. I do consultations with dancers online as well as in person in Sacramento. Most people who I see online, I do require that they have seen an in-person provider. I cannot diagnose, but I can help you on your journey, especially if you have something that's a little bit more complex or you feel like the pieces of the puzzle need to be put together. So my clinic is Performance Pilates and Rehab. My website is performancepilatesrehab.com. I'm on Instagram under leahbueno.performancepilatesrehab. I should know my own handle. leahbueno.pilatesrehab. Let me say that again. Yeah, and you can reach out to me. I was doing some education programs through COVID for dance educators. I really am hoping to do that again. Life has gotten in the way, but stay tuned and hopefully I have some ideas that I will be able to become reality very, very soon.
I love that. Yes. And I will make sure to share out all the different links and things so people can find you that much easier when they go to find you. Thank you very much for your time today. It was so much fun getting to chat with you again. Dance Med Spotlight is hosted and produced by Alyssa Arms. We discuss all things dance medicine. This has been another episode from Dance Med Spotlight. The Dance Med Spotlight is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present.